Citigroup pays up for past deeds.
And consumers seem to be spending again. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. It's the Marketplace Midday Update for Thursday, August 30th. Coming up, we're hearing a lot about jobs and the economy, of course, from the Republican National Convention. But there's also been a lot of talk in the speeches about education. And there's been some recent polling on Americans' attitudes about education. We'll learn more about that.
Also, how do you get kids to eat their broccoli? We are going to find out what the latest research says about that coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Citigroup will pay almost $600 million to settle a lawsuit brought by its own shareholders. The complaint against the giant bank dates back to before the financial crisis. Investors said Citi concealed its exposure to risky mortgage assets. Earlier this week, we learned the SEC is investigating Ally Financial for its own mortgage practices around that time. Suddenly, it's like the chickens of 2008 and 2007 are finally coming home to roost. Our New York reporter Mark Garrison's here to talk about it. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Jeff.
So wrap up the Citigroup settlement for us.
Well, it's among the biggest settlements tied to the economic crisis. And as you know, Citi lost a fortune in the housing bust. We're talking $27.5 billion in 2008. This hammered its stock, which to this day is, you know, still at a fraction of its value before the crisis. So investors sued, saying Citi was not honest about all the toxic mortgage assets that were actually on its books. They used pretty strong language, calling Citi's accounting a, quote, quasi-Ponzi scheme. So this settlement is essentially Citi saying to investors, here's $590 million. We're not saying we did anything wrong, but let's just all move on.
4 years, 5 years now after the financial crisis, why does it feel like we're just now getting around to addressing a lot of the legal issues around it?
Well, the reality is these cases are so complex, they can take 4 or 5 years or more to play out. I mean, the Citigroup case, for example, it had 40 million pages of documents to review. And we know these
Wow.
mortgage-backed securities, they were often just so complicated that people buying and selling them didn't even understand them. So you can imagine how it's going to take some time for lawyers and litigators to look at those and find out what's going on. And the Ally case, I think the bottom line there is that the Securities and Exchange Commission and other watchdogs, they're still investigating. We're not done.
One thing we've also heard is it can be complicated to determine what's civil or criminal liability and what's just bad investment choices.
Well, look, Jeff, all investments carry risk, whether it's these exotic collateralized debt obligations we've been talking about or just plain old stocks and bonds. So these cases basically turn on whether the companies misled investors. Did they tell them everything they knew about the risks they were taking, the quality of the investments they were offering, so investors could actually make a good choice, or were they just keeping them in the dark?
Mark Garrison, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Isaac is back to tropical storm status this morning with top sustained winds around 45 miles per hour. But it's very slow moving as it continues to dump rain on the state of Louisiana. Residents in the northwest part of the state are preparing homes and businesses for potential flooding. And area hotels are full as the people of South Louisiana wait out the storm. Kate Archer Kent of Red River Radio reports.
A diesel engine powers a sandbag filling machine in the small town of Benton, Louisiana. Prison inmates from the Bossier Parish Correctional Facility have stockpiled 15,000 sandbags that are provided free to local residents. Ronnie Andrews is the parish's public works director. He doesn't think the sandbags will be necessary, but he says it doesn't hurt to be overprepared.
If we need to, we'll work around the clock. If not, we'll regroup the next day. But I don't think that's going to hurt us too bad as dry as it's been around here.
Each car can take up to 25 sandbags for free. And those prison inmates who fill the sandbags, by the way, they don't get paid for their labor. In Benton, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer Kent for Marketplace.
Stock markets fell around the world today, and the early prognosis, clicking over here, looks similar in the U.S. Europe, as is often the case, is a likely factor. Portugal's government announced its budget deficit this year will exceed by quite a bit the level it agreed to in exchange for bailout funds. Poland says its economy is slowing down. And Germany's Angela Merkel is in China, where the premier warned Southern Europe's debtor nations to quit stalling and trim their government spending.
The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits last week remained exactly the same as it was the week before, 374,000. And the government said this morning that consumer spending grew 0.4% last month. That is the fastest pace in 5 months. For more on this, let's bring in Melody Hobson, no relation to me. She is president of Ariel Investments, and she's with us from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So is the consumer back in a spending mood, Melody?
Well, certainly we've seen that uptick, and that uptick is very encouraging. The consumer represents 2/3 of GDP, so it's a big deal, and that's encouraging news.
Well, do you expect that that is going to continue as we get into the fall? Obviously, we have the European debt crisis, which may get worse in the coming months, and the fiscal cliff in Washington, which everyone's worried about.
Well, there's no question there are headwinds, but there's also the back-to-school season, which is upon us, which is probably partially tied to that uptick in spending, and that should continue in the early weeks of September as well. And I think at the end of the day, people got very concerned in the late spring, early summer, as they saw things really heat up in Europe. I think they pulled in their horns, but they saw that the world didn't come to an end and probably feel better and may continue on this spending path because of it.
What do you think is the biggest fear for consumers right now?
I think the job story looms large everywhere in America. Even if you have a job, you're worried that you may not keep it. You're worried that if another shoe drops with this economy, that that could mean a layoff for you. So I think people are very, very tentative.
Still, they're still worried about that.
Still, I think that, yes, when you see, 8.5% unemployment, you can't help but to be concerned. And everyone knows someone who's out of work, even if you have a job. So you see that up close. It has affected, all corners of our society.
Melody Hobson, president of Ariel Investments in Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
And now to the Republican National Convention in Tampa, where Vice Presidential candidate Paul Ryan spoke last night.
After 4 years of getting the runaround, America needs a turnaround, and the man for the job is Governor Mitt Romney.
Tonight, Mitt Romney accepts the GOP nomination for president.
Which brings us to our coverage of the real economy, what matters most to voters this election year. We sent Marketplace's David Gura on a road trip down Interstate 4 in Florida, and he sent this report from the coastal town of New Smyrna Beach.
This is a really charming town, kind of old Florida. There's a busy historic district around Canal Street with small shops and restaurants.
Geographically, I don't think it's grown a lot because we're bounded by the ocean on the east.
I meet Joan Westherin at the New Smyrna Museum of History. She's a lifelong Republican who moved here in 1968.
Most of us, if you've come from some other part of the United States and you love this community, you'd want to keep it compact. And that's really what the city has done.
That's been good news for Roger Kincaid. He sold real estate here for a decade. And he says the market is turning around. Sales are up 8% this year.
Probably 3 out of 5 deals I do right now are cash. And if the banks would just loosen up and let people take advantage of that low interest rate, it would be a great time.
Joan Westherin told me that one reason she thinks the community has done okay is there are a lot of retirees like her living here on fixed incomes. But if you're not retired, this place is different. Farther up Canal Street, I meet Joy Traballo. She grew up in New Smyrna Beach and moved back here 2 years ago. She trained to be a child life specialist at Johns Hopkins. But she says there isn't much demand for that type of work here.
I have lots of degrees and have done lots of different things, but choose to stay in this area to help care for my mom, who's elderly and not well.
So Traballo works as a receptionist. She answers the phone for a financial advisor on Canal Street. The work's not bad, she tells me. She likes her boss and the customers.
I just immediately started doing whatever I could find just to generate money. But, it's a low-paying job. It's nothing near what you need to survive financially.
The economy weighs heavily on her mind ahead of the election. And Traballo says President Obama has had his chance to turn things around.
I think we do not have the jobs that we need. I think our economy has just kind of gone down the tube. Not saying it's all his fault, but I do not think he has the honest leadership and the guts to do what's right.
Traballo didn't vote for President Obama in 2008, and she says she's not going to vote for him this November. The current administration, she tells me, has failed. In New Smyrna Beach, Florida, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
So far, the big Republican National Convention speeches have featured plenty of talk on jobs and the deficit. Something a little more surprising, at least to me, Jeremy, has been the emphasis on teachers and schools. There's been a lot of that. Well, Gallup, just this month, surveyed Americans on their opinions about the education system. So we're going to take that on for today's attitude check.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
It's our weekly partnership with Gallup and editor-in-chief Frank Newport. Hi, Frank.
Hi, good morning.
How do Americans in general feel about the education kids are getting at public versus other kinds of schools?
Well, the surprising thing to us was how well charter schools did. Now, I can give you the big picture. We gave Americans five different types of schools, from private and parochial and charter and homeschooling and public schools. Private schools were at the very top of the chart. But 60% of Americans said charter schools provide an excellent or good education, a little below parochial schools and then below independent private schools. The other fact is that Americans are very negative on public schools. Only 37% of Americans said they would give public schools in this country a excellent or good rating in terms of how well they educate the kids there.
Well, let's break it down. First of all, parents versus non-parents in the survey.
Which is quite interesting. And keep in mind, in this sample, 83% of these parents have public school kids. So as I say, that's the majority of them. They're really not that different in terms of rating everything except for public schools. And there, parents are 10 points higher in their perception of how well kids are educated at public schools. But still, even for parents, public schools are down there tied with homeschooling at the bottom of the list.
How about distinctions between Republicans and Democrats?
Ah, there's politics in everything, right?
These days, you bet.
Yeah, Republicans, of course, push for non-traditional schooling, charter schooling, and, of course, homeschooling. Republicans more likely to have kids homeschooled. The big difference is in homeschooling. 16-point swing there for Republicans saying, hey, homeschooling provides a good education as opposed to what Democrats say. However, Republicans 13 points less likely to say public schools do a good job than Democrats. So there's a big gap there in those perceptions.
A lot of numbers. Thanks for them. Frank Newport from Gallup.
My pleasure.
The Standard Setters for American School Lunches are rebalancing the menu this fall. They're aiming at the eternal task of getting kids to eat more fruits and veggies. And now some new research out of Cornell University offers up a few ideas on how to get kids to actually eat those carrots or broccoli. Sabri Benishore has the story.
Theodore Seegers has seven kids, and he says it's not easy to get them to eat well.
No, it's not. They'll want a bag of M&Ms over, you know, an apple or orange. They sometimes get a little attitude.
Well, Cornell University professor David Just tried a little experiment on a few hundred preschoolers. He put cookies and apples in front of them at lunchtime and then got the number of kids who put an apple on their lunch tray to increase by 70%.
We'd put a sticker that had a little cartoon drawing of Elmo on it, right? The Sesame Street character.
That's it. Branding. So why don't you have Spider-Man carrots and SpongeBob oranges everywhere? Richard Sexton is professor of agricultural and resource economics at UC Davis.
There's not large and powerful branded players, you know, for example, fresh fruits and vegetables, and so there tends not to be the advertising.
He says it'd be tough to get a bunch of independent small farmers to sign on to an expensive ad campaign. That's why you do find organic pizza branded with Big Bird. But for the Elmo apples, you might have to wait. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
One of the most fought over energy frontiers these days is beneath the icy waters of the Arctic. Ice is melting faster, making it easier to extract oil and gas. So it might come as a surprise that the Russian state-owned gas company Gazprom said this week it is halting development of a natural gas field in the Arctic. Reporter Peter Van Dyke joins us from Moscow with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, so why is Gazprom putting this big project on hold?
Well, primarily because it's very expensive and they haven't been able to come to reasonable financial terms with their two foreign partners, which is Norway's Statoil and France's Total. And part of that is because the price of gas has come down. And that is very important, obviously, for any of these technologically challenging offshore developments, but also this one in particular, because one of the reasons the price of gas has come down is the shale gas boom in the US. And that has also closed off a potential export market for this gas for Gazprom, because they were hoping by 2020 to supply about 10% of the North American gas market. But right now, because of shale gas, gas, the U.S. is an exporter of natural gas.
And Peter, does this mean that these Arctic waters that everybody has been fighting over because of all of the resources beneath the ice might not be as valuable as first thought?
Well, in the short term, it does mean that, but there are still other projects that are going forward, and Exxon and Rosneft, the state oil company, did a deal recently to explore some Arctic areas, so that's going ahead. And there's certainly no chance that Russia is going to give up any claims to the Arctic, because it does see it as an important area to develop for the future. And Gazprom itself said that this is only for now, and if the market conditions or the cost of the technology changes, then it will certainly review this decision to put this project on hold.
Reporter Peter Van Dyke in Moscow, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, Jeremy, regular listeners of the Midday Update know that if there is a list of cities or states or countries that comes out, we are likely to spot it and bring it to them. So today we have which American cities spoil their kids the most? We've got an answer to that pressing question from the website Bundle.com. They looked at toy and clothing spending for kids across major metropolitan areas. And so here's a sampling of the ranking. Two New York boroughs, where you are, Jeremy, Manhattan and Brooklyn, spend the most per household.
Really?
Manhattan by a good bit, and there's a reason for that, I think, and I'll mention in a moment. But New York is followed closely by Miami and Minneapolis. Oddly enough, St. Paul, Minnesota, which is my home originally, is only 10 miles away from Minneapolis, is near the very bottom of the list. Kind of curious. The other two cities that spend the least on kiddie items are both in Wisconsin, Milwaukee and Madison. And here's my theory about part of what's going on here is that this is based on where people do their shopping, right? They use sort of retail sales figures.
Oh.
And so if people
from a lot of people doing shopping in Manhattan that don't actually live there.
Yeah, I'm sure Manhattan looks a lot worse here, as does Minneapolis probably, than is actually the case because people go there to do their shopping. So that clouds things a little bit, but still interesting.
Well, finally, to Dayton, Ohio, where a man was robbed at a bus stop on Tuesday. The robbers took the victim's cell phone and $40, but they weren't heartless, these robbers. According to the Dayton Daily News, they did give the victim back $2 in cash so that he'd have enough money for the bus.
Oh, that's thoughtful.
Heartwarming, isn't it? Yeah, really nice.
Oh, well, we should make a list of the cities with the friendliest robbers. In Los Angeles, where I have yet to experience it, I'm sure our robbers are very friendly.
No, I don't think you should try that one out.
Okay. You're right. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.